Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm Gabriele Wienhausen. I'm the Associate Dean for Education in the Division of Biological Sciences, and I'm fortunate to be the moderator for this session. So diversity is our future, and you see the names of everybody participating in this session. And if you looked at the schedule for the Ideas Conference, what you will see is that this session was introduced with this text. And I will just read it. As we forge ahead into the next half century, a diverse campus community is essential for the university to keep at the forefront of innovation and find solutions to challenges facing the world. So, because I'm a teacher, I like to kind of unpack a little bit what this says. So why is a diverse campus essential? Our own president said that it is an explicit value of the University of California. He said, the University of California stands for a commitment to access and opportunity for all Californians. Diversity and openness are in our DNA. We also have to create a diverse campus because we really truly owe this to our students and their future success as professionals. Research has demonstrated, and I've just listed one from UCLA, Aston, that a diverse student body produces better educated graduates with more highly developed cognitive abilities, interpersonal skills, and leadership abilities. The National Research Council said something very similar and said, college education should really prepare students for a future by offering them opportunities to learn about a world and people beyond their own experience and work effectively with people whose backgrounds differ from their own. Very similarly, there was a report produced by Hart Research Associates last year, and one of the key competencies employers want to see in college graduates is that they can work effectively in diverse groups. The Howard Hughes Medical Institute and the Association of American Colleges identified very clearly that application of scientific knowledge in medicine requires attention, both to the patient as an individual and in the social context. And last and by no means least, the American Association for Sciences identified as one of the core competencies for successful scientists to work effectively in a diverse environment. So now we know why it is important. But the statement that I read to you earlier also said it is essential, diversity is essential for keeping at the forefront of innovation. And is that really true? And again, research is clearly stating that diverse groups have a potential to be more creative and more innovative. And the emphasis is here, have the potential. What is necessary for a diverse group to be effective is that members of the group have to have certain competencies. They have to have trust, they have to respect each other, they have to have an ability to listen, an ability to be open and not being judgmental. So in other words, diversity in itself does not lead to creativity and innovation. So how can we get there? How can we develop these kinds of competencies? Well, what we have to do is we have to reach out, we have to get involved in each other's communities, and we must make an effort to get to know and understand and appreciate each other's worlds. And we must make an effort to seek dialogue, to listen with an open spirit. So, what have we done? And what are we doing? We, as you will hear later in a very short period of time, we are reaching out to build relationships. We indeed visit the other community, and we interact with students and their families. We go to Compton High and show that we care and that we respect them. We are providing academic opportunities to help young students visualize that going to college is a real possibility. We are inviting students from Compton to live on our campus for a couple of weeks to take classes so that they can get to know us and we can get to know them better. We are providing academic support to make a dream become educational reality. We are providing tutoring, pre-college preparation for inner-city youth to enhance their performance in math, science, and writing. And we are providing the means to realize educational goals. We are fundraising for scholarship to make college attendance possible. And by reaching out, by getting to know each other, not just as statistics, but as real human beings, we actually find out how little we knew and how little we understood. And what we learn and what we start to understand is why meritocracy alone is an insufficient tool, and that without what one would call common ground, we will not be in a place where others can see themselves succeeding. A few days before this presentation, I received an email from Sandy, one of the presenters, and she shared with me the personal experience of one of our many biology students. The student was frustrated because she felt that her peers don't seem to be sensitive or care much about cultural awareness or differences. The student was dismayed that the human element never comes into play much in her science classes. For most of us faculty, especially in the sciences and engineering, the concept that our own cultural background ever influences our teaching truly comes as a huge surprise. Many of us believe that we just have to teach the facts, just teach about cell division and abnormal cell division such as cancer. Don't bother to try to make it relevant to students' lives or to our society. If they, the students, are really, truly scientists, all they want to know are the underlying facts, right? No. Biology, or for that matter, physics, or math, or fill in the dots, is not a decontextualized subject matter. The young student I just quoted made that clear. And research has actually compiled tons of data that supports her statement. By insisting that science or engineering or math or you fill in the dots is all about facts, we alienate. And it is important, really important, to understand that small instructional changes will make a difference. Decontextualizing science, which is really a big mouthful word, right, and really frightening. But what it takes, for example, is to start the learning process with a real-world problem. For example, sharing the story of a community member with a rare form of cancer. So we will change how we teach our subject matter and all will be all right, correct? Instead of answering that question, I would like to share another quote from one of our science students. Many professors like to feed cliched stereotypes in such a way that it actually polarizes the classroom. People are less willing to interact. What to do now? This quote highlights that we do not only have to reflect about how we teach our discipline, but also how we interact and communicate with our students. Our students come with a broad spectrum of academic, socioeconomic, ethnic, cultural, and social backgrounds. And this does create a challenge for us, which is to build a classroom climate of inclusion, respect, connection, and caring. Otherwise, our students cannot succeed. So, have we done all of those things? Well, the reason that I'm talking about this, you already guessed that, is that we actually have amazing examples, inspiring examples, that help us see that we have started to do some of those things. We are not trying to say that we are there, by no means. But this is about being inspired. This is about understanding that we can do. This is about understanding that it is important to have ideas and that ideas can become reality. It is with great pleasure that I introduce our first speaker, who is Christopher Janov. Christopher is actually a proud UCSD alum who graduated here in 99, and he's the founder and executive director of Reality Changers, I'm very sorry, Chris, which seeks to provide inner-city youth from disadvantaged backgrounds with the resources to become first-generation college students. Chris?
If diversity truly is our future, what must be done? I'm here to share with you a story about Reality Changers, how we got to Reality Changers becoming California's leading tutoring program for scholarships, and then give some advice on what we can do as a campus and as a community to increase diversity here at UC San Diego. When I was a freshman at this school in 1996, I was majoring in political science and Spanish literature, and I decided to improve my Spanish. I would work as a volunteer at a Spanish-speaking church in their youth program. And there was one student involved in gangs at that time when I got there, and within a year, he brought his friends and their friends and their friends. And by the time I was a sophomore at this school, I was leading a program full of bald-headed gang members. Not something you find on the La Jolla campus here, just 10 minutes south, that's what was happening. And for the next 5 years, while I was leading this youth program, I saw the shootings and the killings, and even I myself got stabbed right in front of my face. And when I went into the teaching profession, I saw these smart 7th and 8th graders getting A's and B's, but knowing their older brothers and sisters, I knew they'd probably be dropping out in 9th and 10th grade. So in May of 2001, less than 10 years ago, decided to start a new program called Reality Changers with just $300 to our name, because it's just not right that most inner city teenagers today know more people who have been shot or killed in the street than people who are on the road to college. And our purpose when we began Reality Changers was to work with 8th graders to get them to improve their grades so that they could come here to UC San Diego's newest summer program called Academic Connections, a college immersion program for high school students where they can come on campus, live here for 3 weeks, take college courses, and actually earn college credit before even becoming sophomores in high school. Now, if you take a look at one of our yearbooks here today, we've now given out more scholarships to students to come to Academic Connections than any other program. The Secretary of Education has come visited Reality Changers twice during the past year, proclaiming Reality Changers as a model not just for the city or the state, but for the entire country. And I brought a couple of videos, but I want to introduce to you a couple of the students. If you open up on the inside cover, last year's class of just 40 students earned over $4 million in scholarships to schools all across the country. And thank you. Including two Gates Millennium scholarships to two students, and it's an average of $100,000 per student. And this is, we've given out $2 million in scholarships now. The university has given out $8 million. So we're getting a 4-to-1 return on investment from inner city, low income, 17-year-olds going off to college. If you turn one more page, the first student here is Jesse Sanchez. He lives close to our headquarters in the neighborhood of City Heights, which the Union Tribune once called the rotting core of America's finest city, and currently holds a title as the probation capital of San Diego. Jesse's annual family income was just $7,000 a year until he got a full ride to Harvard for $215,000. Michael Galden was homeless for 10 years, living in the back seat of a broken-down automobile. His only dream was to apply to another school in town, and unfortunately he got turned down from that school. But because he was in Reality Changers, where we encourage / force our students to apply to at least a dozen schools, he was accepted on a full-ride scholarship to UCLA, where he's currently a freshman. Arlene was selling flowers on the side of a freeway off-ramp in southeast San Diego for $3 a bushel till the very last day she left for Chicago on a full-ride scholarship to Northwestern for $200,000. I sit on the city's gang commission, so I know that this next student, Ashley, she lives close to this five-block stretch in San Diego that's the most dangerous part of the city. There have been 10 gang-related homicides on this five-block stretch in the past 5 years alone. That means as often as you and I change our clocks, there's someone bleeding to death outside of Ashley's home. She got a $203,000 scholarship to go to Duke. And Eduardo, the last story, was the feature of this video. Eduardo was facing 6 years in jail as a freshman in high school. The judge said, Eduardo, I'm going to give you 1 month to prove to me that you're the man inside this yearbook from 2006 instead of the kid that the cops arrested. And in that month, he doubled his GPA to 3.8, got 13 letters of recommendation, and won the top two design prizes in a mechanical engineering class right here on this campus. That's right, the bald-headed kid from the toughest part of town got the top two prizes here at this engineering school. Would you like to see him in this video? Yay or nay?
Yay.
All right, now that you're excited about it, let's roll the first tape. Reality Changers, he was honored on the floor of the United States Congress less than a year later. Enjoy.
I want to share with you an inspirational story about a young man from my district in San Diego. Eduardo Corona faced up to 6 years in a juvenile correctional facility. Instead of going to that facility, the judge met with him and spoke with him and allowed Eduardo to participate in a mentoring program called Reality Changers. I've had an opportunity to meet with the young people in that program, and I can tell you, they are inspirational and very engaged in their lives and hoping to change the community someday. Reality Changers brings at-risk youth in San Diego together with their mentors, half of which are college students from the University of California, San Diego. And for about 3 hours a week, over 4 year time, these mentees study with their peer mentors. They take weekly practice, SAT tests, do homework together, listen to guest speakers, and take part in leadership development seminars. In addition to that, Reality Changers also sends its participants, all of which come from low-income families, to a summer program at UCSD where they take college-level courses and prepare for higher education. With the help of his mentors in Reality Changers, Eduardo was able to turn his life around. In just 30 days, and this is kind of remarkable to me as I had a chance to work with some of the issues that he had to deal with, Eduardo doubled his GPA to 3.8. He attended UCSD's summer program and won two awards in mechanical engineering. And although he's just a sophomore in high school, he has already earned college credit and is well on his way to becoming the first member of his family to attend college. In fact, I need to tell you that all of Reality Changers participants who have completed this four-year program have gone on to a four-year university. Not bad, considering all of these young people are the first in their families to attend college. I think Eduardo's story really tells us and proves that with the right role models and people who truly care about them, our society's most challenged youth, challenged in many different ways, can turn their lives around and become leaders in our community. I ask all my colleagues to join me in support of increased funding for our nation's mentoring programs, because we know that with that help, we can replicate Eduardo's success all around the country.
If diversity is our future, if diversity is our future, what must be done? Eduardo Corona put UC San Diego in the congressional record. How many more Eduardo Coronas are out there waiting to be found in San Diego's inner city? See, how do we expect our students to grow up to be doctors if the only time they have interaction with the medical community is if they go to a clinic every other week with their moms? Or grow up to be marine biologists if they've never investigated the bottom of a swimming pool before? Or to become journalists if all they ever see is what's written up and scrawled on the walls of their neighborhood? But by supporting Reality Changers and sending more of them to UC San Diego's academic connections, these students can take classes like cognitive neuroscience, life in the underwater sea forest, and a journalism class where they can write newspapers and online stories as well. So what happened to Eduardo and the rest of the class of 2010? Well, let's take a look in this final video that celebrates last year's graduating class and asks the question, why are we called reality changers?
Sometimes I lay under the moon. I thank God I'm breathing. And I pray, don't take me soon, 'cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't wanna fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay.
So now, how many of you want to see more UC San Diego sweatshirts in the next video? Well, there's something that we can do. There is an idea that was generated just steps away from where we're sitting here today in the Chancellor's Office of a guaranteed admissions program for Reality Changer students who meet the high expectations of the program and who meet the high expectations of this university. This idea, which was generated, again, just a few steps away from where we are today, has been adopted by other universities and has drawn interest from other national universities. It is still under consideration here at UC San Diego's Academic Senate. So you can support Reality Changers and our mission to get more students here to UC San Diego through that avenue. And I'll end just how I started. If diversity is our future, what must be done? Well, we must take action to change reality changers and to change reality for this university. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak here today.
Good afternoon. I have to say I am very inspired after that presentation by Chris. I think that's just wonderful. I'm going to be talking perhaps on a little bit more of an academic level, but this being UCSD's 50th anniversary year, we take particular pride at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, where it can be said it all began for UCSD. Roger Revelle came to La Jolla Shores as a UC Berkeley graduate student in 1931, and he went on to become a world-class oceanographer and director of Scripps in 1950. His idea, power of an idea, for establishing a graduate program in science and engineering adjacent to Scripps advanced an even grander vision for a new campus of the University of California here on the La Jolla Mesa. In its young life, UCSD has risen to the top ranks of the nation's universities, and by so many measures is really impressive. And while Scripps remains one of the very top institutions in its field, for training the next generation of oceanographers, geophysicists, marine biologists, ecologists, atmospheric scientists, we do struggle in attracting a more diverse pool of applicants, students who are interested in pursuing advanced degrees in these fields. The percentage of students applying to our PhD program at Scripps who self-identify as African-American, Latino, or Chicano, Native American, and Pacific Islander, all combined, they represent less than 10% of our applicant pool over the last 10 years. Those same ethnic groups make up about 19% of the undergraduate population here at UCSD, and about 45% of the population of the state of California. So, there's something wrong with this picture. But, you know, a question that many of us have heard asked, and more often it seems lately since the election of President Obama and the premature declaration of the post-racial society, and it's a question we hear on the public airwaves, on the blogosphere, and even within the ranks of our own faculty and students at this institution, asking, why are people always bringing up race and gender and all this talk about diversity? We live in a meritocracy where intelligence, hard work, and perseverance determine who gains access to the most competitive institutions, where the best and brightest can achieve to their highest potential. Right? Well, not exactly, as any student of history knows, though I think we can all agree on the goal of a level playing field and the vision of a colorblind society. But we're not there yet. The disparity or imbalance of minority student representation in our universities compared to the demographics of the general population is a fact. It's not new. It's not unique to California. Although, as a public university serving one of the nation's most diverse states, the challenge for the UC system is certainly more apparent. And putting aside for a moment the contentiousness over affirmative action, the legacy of Prop 209, or discussion of concepts such as white privilege, which are all topics of healthy debate on our campuses, I'd like to focus on another conversation that has been taking place within government and the private sector. And that has to do with the importance of a diverse, skilled national workforce. There's a little disagreement on the benefits of a heterogeneous versus a homogeneous assemblage of talent on your team when it comes to problem solving and innovation, which of course are the driving factors of competitiveness in the global economy. Now, as UCSD has taken on the mantle of a top-tier research university, distinguished by strong science and engineering programs, not to mention its excellent liberal arts and educational offerings, we are naturally attuned to the articulated concerns of major funding institutions like the National Science Foundation, the NIH, NASA, NOAA, as well as the national academies, and business and technology leaders. These groups and individuals have recognized the need to recruit more minorities into science, technology, engineering, and math, what we refer to as the STEM fields. And this, they talk about this as a matter of national economic competitiveness. By the way, this acronym gets used a lot, so I just thought I would put it up for clarity. When I say STEM, I'm talking about these and related fields. But just as important as the national competitiveness argument, from our perspective at Scripps, a diverse and skilled talent pool is a critical asset in finding the breakthroughs that address global problems from human health to the environment, in advancing our understanding of complex ecosystem functions and responses to cumulative impacts of resources extraction, energy use, and climate change, This is our business down the hill. A decade ago, the Commission on the Advancement of Women and Minorities in Science, Engineering, and Technology Development called for a strengthening of high school preparation and transition to college programs, along with financial assistance for underrepresented minorities to pursue science and engineering degrees. And I should note that significant progress has been made in increasing opportunities for traditionally underrepresented students, more in some places than others. There are great programs and communities of support here at UCSD and at most universities, providing attention to the particular needs of students, first-generation college-goers, returning students, Native Americans, African Americans, Chicanos, LGBT students, all with the goal of ensuring that these students succeed in college. And as we'll hear from Sandy in a minute, these programs and efforts do make a difference in the lives and success of students on our campuses. In 2005, a seminal report, really, by the National Academy of Sciences sounded the call for a strong and talented science and technology workforce. Its report, Rising Above the Gathering Storm, helped usher in substantial federal investments in research and education through the America Competes Act and the stimulus spending of recently up to 2009. And last year, they updated their report, underscoring the urgency of the situation. But the most compelling case for diversity as an asset to the nation's science and engineering workforce was made by a congressionally appointed consortium of academic and research institution representatives, chaired by Freeman Hrabowski, who is president of the University of Maryland at Baltimore County. They have a wonderful program there called the Meyerhoff Scholars Program, and we're lucky to host many of the Meyerhoff Scholars students in our summer research programs at Scripps and throughout UCSD. These next few slides are an extreme condensation of this really excellent report entitled Expanding Underrepresented Minority Participation, America's Science and Technology Talent at the Crossroads. So, underrepresented minorities comprise about 29% of our national population. This is actually 2006 figures. It's probably higher now. Yet, just over 9% of college-educated Americans in science and engineering occupations. This slide shows that we have underproduction of minorities in science and engineering at every stage of post-secondary education. These bars show, the blue bar is the percentage of underrepresented minorities, and the light blue bar are non-URM. And you can see as you go up the chain, this percentage falls, decreases. Now, there's always been attrition of students entering college as science and engineering majors and dropping out or switching to a less challenging non-STEM degree. But the attrition rates are disproportionately higher for underrepresented minorities than they are for white students. The other thing this slide shows is that non-US citizens, especially from China and India, have accounted for almost all the growth in STEM doctorate level degrees over the past decade. Foreign students now earn more than half of the doctorates awarded in the U.S. in math, science, and engineering. So, this question asks, can the U.S. continue to rely on a science and engineering workforce essentially imported from overseas? This report also talks about demographic trends, which are compelling and, in a way, inspiring. The groups most underrepresented in STEM are the fastest growing in the general population. So this diversity within our population is an asset and an opportunity, since the science and engineering workforce is projected to grow faster than any other sector of the economy. The report also talks about specific factors that are important for underrepresented minorities students to succeed in their pursuit of science and engineering degrees and careers. These conditions are what allow the students to acquire the knowledge and skills, put them into practice, which in turn nurtures their development and identity as a chemist or a biologist or an engineer. So the students begin to take on that ownership of that identity. And mentorship, as Chris has pointed out, is really critical throughout this process at every level, from middle school, high school, through college and into the advanced degrees. Finally, I want to highlight an outreach program that Scripps initiated last year to engage students and teachers from Compton High School, to expose them to the many fields of knowledge and exploration represented at Scripps and at UCSD. Ironically, the impetus for this effort was an ugly racist incident on our campus last year that ignorantly targeted the Compton community, causing real hurt among people who live there and within our own campus community. But it has blossomed into something positive, powerful, and life-changing. And I want to acknowledge from the start our partners in this effort, the Academic Connections Program that's run by UCSD Extension. We couldn't have done it without them. They really have an excellent model and the infrastructure to support this program, which brings students here, like Chris said, for 3 weeks to get a taste of college life. Our goals are to engage students' minds and imaginations with unique experiential learning opportunities and activities that will hopefully deepen their understanding of the geosciences, our fields of study, while also serving as preparation for senior year advanced placement coursework. And this is something that we generated in our first meeting with the students at Compton. And our outreach to Compton actually was born from an idea of one of our own students who had ties to that community and was personally moved and felt it was our duty to go there and let them know the true face of UCSD, what this university is about. We also want to expand their awareness of potential career avenues in STEM fields, highlighting the range of disciplines and the variety of positions that are available in industry, in government, and academia. Another part of this program is to provide professional development for the teachers at these partner schools. Through direct interaction, teacher to Scripps scientists, infusing the teachers' lesson plans with new content, new insights, and inspiration. We also want, through this program, to provide strategic guidance on the University of California admissions process for both students and teachers. And that's part of what they get when they're here for the 3 weeks over the summer. So as I mentioned, these are the basic program elements. 3 weeks, they live in the dorms, they attend lectures in the mornings, they do lab activities in the afternoons, and the Scripps sort of spin on this, the students that we support through scholarships to be able to participate in this program at no cost to themselves, the ticket for that is you're forced to learn about our area of research. So this coming summer, we have 5 of the Academic Connections courses being taught by Scripps graduate students. And all of the students from Compton, and we've now expanded to 3 other high schools in San Diego, which are San Diego High School downtown, Mission Bay High School, and Lincoln High School. Those students will have their choice of those 5 courses. And then they will also get the full Academic Connections program experience. The teacher component has been kind of focused more into one week where they are also here on campus, living here and interacting with our researchers, getting professional development, and then carrying that throughout the school year with Scripps faculty and staff visiting these schools, which is already taking place right now with Compton High School. Our director, Tony Hammett, will be there next week again, and that's something we want to replicate with all of the schools that we partner with through this program. In closing, I want to highlight an opinion piece that was written, again, this was shortly after the racist incidents last year. Cecil Lytle, who was his professor emeritus and provost emeritus of the Thurgood Marshall College here, and Bud Meehan, professor and director of the Center for Research and Educational Equity Assessment and Teaching Excellence, which is called CREATE, they wrote this piece, which you can find online, talking about, the title, When Done Is Not Enough. I think that was taken from I think the chancellor was quoted as in response to the student demands saying that something had been done, in the same theme that was raised earlier. Are we done? No, we're not done. And I just wanted to point out a couple quotes from their piece, which is recognizing that although Yeah, it's great to provide more resources and attention to recruit and enroll diverse populations. The real challenge is to be out there in the community and for to be preparing more students to be competitive for entry into UCSD and the UC system. Right now, all the UC campuses and the other private universities around the country are competing for the same very small pool of students who are prepared well enough, have the SAT scores and the grades and the level of preparation to gain admission to our universities. These authors ask, what if the UC campuses stop the disgraceful springtime bidding war for the survivors of California's faltering public schools? What if our leadership took this opportunity to direct its resources and entrepreneurial talent at the root causes behind the low? It's probably 1.7. Actually, I think we're closer to 2% now, but still a very low percentage of African-American students here. And I should mention, Cecil Lytle was instrumental in the creation of the Preuss School here at UCSD, which has been nationally recognized as one of the best schools. It does a wonderful job of preparing students from underserved, disadvantaged communities. But it's just one school. What if we had a dozen Preuss schools? And the last question, another what if. What if USC took the opportunity of its 50th anniversary, achieving the extraordinary, to look beyond the ivory tower and expand on the success of the Preuss School and partnerships. So as I mentioned, as has been mentioned, we are doing this, but a lot more needs to be done. I'll just end with one of my favorite quotes from Dr. Martin Luther King, which is inspirational in itself in giving us the realization that change is incremental. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it does bend towards justice, and I think about that in the context of what we're doing. So I thank you very much.
So I think we're all here today because we recognize that an acknowledgement and an appreciation of diversity is really critical for a functioning society, especially a socially just functioning society. And it certainly should be a part of every student's college education. In the sciences, however, this acknowledgement and appreciation of diversity is often overlooked, in spite of the fact that diversity is key to long-term progress in science, as we've heard Gabriella, Ken, and Chris talk about. So what people, especially scientists, fail to acknowledge is that science is a social endeavor, and it has become increasingly more collaborative. We know from a number of studies that diverse teams solve problems more effectively than homogeneous teams. And so as scientists and as educators, we have a duty to increase the diversity of students in the classroom, and we have a duty as educators to equip them with the tools to interact effectively with one another. But this isn't a task that many of us whose job it is to educate these students have been explicitly trained to do. So Ken referred to some of this data that I'll just spend a small amount of time talking about, and that is the issue that, you know, first of all, we have a hard time recruiting underrepresented students into higher education in general, and certainly into the science, technology, engineering, and math fields. But once they're here, we have a hard time retaining students in general. So what this graph shows is less than 50% of all students who intend to major in the STEM disciplines actually complete a degree in their chosen major within 4 or 5 years. And this loss of students is much higher for historically underrepresented students, with less than 20% of Black, Latino, and Chicano, and Native American students achieving this degree. And I want to be clear that there have been many studies and surveys of hundreds of students across many universities in this country, and this loss does not correlate to a lack of talent or a lack of ability. What this loss does correlate with is a lack of awareness. And this is often on the part of faculty. So many faculty members and the sciences do not realize that the identities of their students can and should play a role in their learning. And this can create an environment in which students feel they do not belong. And Gabriella shared some quotes with you from a student in the biological sciences. And students can feel the material they are learning seems irrelevant, to the issues that are important to their lives and to the lives of their communities. So why would they want to stay in a major that has absolutely nothing to do with them or their communities? And why don't faculty teach in ways that are more culturally sensitive and culturally relevant? And that pretty much boils down to a lack of training. It's certainly not a lack of heart. Many of us are not formally trained on how to educate students at the college level. And so we've never encountered the concept of cultural competence in the classroom and the role of student identity in learning. But thankfully, there have been efforts throughout the country with the goal of addressing the lack of diversity in the STEM disciplines, and potential solutions have arisen from a number of these studies that appear to help retain talented students regardless of their cultural, gender, and racial background. And the goal of our workshop is to help address these, help equip TAs with these tools. So I just want to spend a few minutes, since there might be some educators in this room. Some of these tips are really easy. One is to convey that ability is developed and not innate. Another is to address different learning styles. As I mentioned before, to make course content relevant to the students' lives, to show examples of professionals in the field that represent the students in your classroom, which requires you to use examples of scientists from various backgrounds, and to use collaborative techniques. And so, as I mentioned, these are the tools that we're hoping to equip TAs with through our workshop. And why are we focusing on TAs? Well, for many students who take introductory courses in the STEM disciplines, these courses can either be gateways or they can be weeder courses, and that depends on how they're taught. Some of these courses are well over 400 students, and so these students, their primary interaction with instructors in the course is actually through the TAs. They rarely have an opportunity to talk to the faculty, and this is just a physical reality of large course sizes. So there's a need, obviously, for TA training if they're going to be the primary contact for these students. But so where do postdocs fit in? As I mentioned, this is an initiative started by postdocs in the division. Where do postdocs fit in? And that's actually a good question that we ask ourselves a lot. So as postdocs, we're kind of in an academic limbo. We're not students, and we're not faculty. And a lot of times, we feel like we don't exist on this university. You know, even registering for events like this, there's no box for postdoc. We have to guess, am I feeling more like a student today? Am I feeling more like faculty today? But, you know, we've recently survived this process of that can be potentially alienating, the selection process. And we've gotten this far, and we still remember what it's like to be students, so we can be a bridge between faculty and students. But that said, most of us postdocs haven't received formal training on the role of identity. We're not necessarily comfortable speaking about diversity. We thought, you know, we should teach in ways that are colorblind, for example. But one of the best ways to learn something is to teach it. And so that's initially where this idea came from. And so I've always wanted to be a teacher since I was about 5, and I always wanted to teach whatever grade I was in. And when I got to college, I knew this is where I wanted to teach. And so I've always been active in trying to learn how to teach better. And last year, I started taking this course on diversity in the college classroom. And I started learning about some of these issues, and I was asked to come up with an action plan. And so I had this idea, and to satisfy my need, I was thinking about me, satisfy my need, I thought I would teach one TA workshop, and then I would be done. That was my action plan. And I mentioned this to Gabriella, and she suggested, why not include other postdocs? Because she realized that the impact of the workshop could be amplified by including other people. And so the workshop that I'm going to describe to you just very briefly would not exist to you in its current form without their ideas and their hard work. So I'm not going to go over the workshop. You're more than welcome to attend one of our workshops if you would like to. But I just wanted to go over a little bit the basic structure and then to highlight a few bits of our workshop that seem to work really well and have the largest impact on our TA participants. So we start off with an icebreaker activity. We don't feel comfortable teaching as we are right here, with one person lecturing at the front and then a passive audience in the back. We really want to get the TAs talking to one another and talking to the postdocs. So we start off with an icebreaker activity. And then we give a short presentation that just tells them about some of the issues that you've heard about today. And then we divide into groups. So we're having these TA participants work in small groups so they can actually think out loud. They can share their ideas with one another. And then we get them to thinking about diversity. And to do this, we use something called the identity wheel. So the goal of our workshop is to get TAs in biology to think about diversity and identity in the classroom, and the role that unconscious bias may play in their interactions with students. But diversity is often used as a buzzword that means different things to different people. And so we use the identity wheel to get TAs to think about diversity in a personal way. So in this way, we're defining diversity for these TAs at this time. So I don't know if you can read everything on the wheel, but it has different aspects, different components of identity, such as ethnicity, age, gender, religion, ability, national origin, socioeconomic class. The wheel that we use in the TA workshop actually has other identities listed as well. And so we ask the TAs to reflect quietly for a few moments about questions such as, which identities do they think about most often? Which do they think about the least? And how do these identities impact them? And then we have them discuss these reflections in small groups before sharing with the room. And what's really come out of this identity wheel is it's actually a powerful tool to allow students to start thinking outside their own sphere. So they start to think about, well, I never think about race as an identity. And why is that? Well, maybe that's because I'm in the majority race and I have the privilege of not having to think about race. So it really, in a safe way, opens up this discussion about identity. The next thing that we focus on, and in fact it's the majority of this workshop, is a case study. So we try not to overwhelm the TA participants with all these abstract facts and figures. We really want to get them to think about a situation they might find themselves in the classroom or in the lab. And so we have an excellent source of this material. You can find it at the Center for the Integration of Research on Teaching and Learning, or CERTL for short. They have awesome materials on how to educate yourself on diversity issues in the sciences and technology fields. And so we choose a case based on what we think the students are primed to hear based on a pre-workshop survey. And again, we have them personally reflect on the case before they work in small groups to discuss questions such as how they might handle a situation in the case and what might the consequences of those actions be. And what might the individuals in the case actually be thinking, and how might they be perceiving each other's actions? So again, it gets them to step outside their own personal sphere and think about what might other people be thinking. And so this is just an example of some of the issues that are raised. So we have guiding questions that kind of guides them to some of the issues we want them to talk about, but it's actually enlightening for us to see how many additional issues the TAs come up with based on their own personal experience, things that we never would have thought of ourselves. So the last thing I want to talk about with this TA training workshop is the evaluation. So how do we know what we're doing is working? We feel good about it when we walk out of the room, but have we actually made an impact? And so one way we assess that is by having students fill out a survey at the end of the workshop, and then we also contact them again at the end of the quarter to see, have they learned anything from the workshop that they didn't think about before? Do they predict that they're going to use the information that they've gained in this workshop? And at the end of the quarter, we again ask them, well, did you do anything differently? And so I wanted to share with you a few of the comments from our evaluation with respect to a few of the components in the workshop. And so with regards to the identity wheel, So as I mentioned, the identity wheel is actually quite useful, a tool to get students in a non-threatening way to think about aspects of identity and diversity that they wouldn't normally think about. And on what might they do differently in class after having taken this, or participated in this workshop. So TAs have reported that they will get students who don't interact to speak up more in group discussions. They've also reported that they will be more aware of favoritism and try not to focus solely on a particular group of students. And on the workshop in general, one of my personal favorite comments is, I was going to leave early because I thought it would be boring, but actually it was pretty intellectually stimulating. I'm glad I chose this workshop. Thanks. And so I'm happy to say that we're off to a good start, but we still have work to do. I want to emphasize that what you've heard about today didn't spring fully formed from any person's mind, and I know it can be easy to get discouraged and feel like you can't make a difference, but I think that what we heard today and at the Teaching Diversity Conference last month is proof that an individual's ideas can make a difference, and that the power is exponentially greater when these ideas are brought together and tested. So here's the second part of your assignment. I want you to tell somebody about your idea, because it's empowering, it's addictive, it's contagious. And you'll be amazed at how many people that you have the potential to help when you do that. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.